about Old Testament reliability. So all we argue is that the Old Testament should be taken seriously as a historical work. It's not a book of mythology, okay? Now, we're going to start with reliability of the New Testament manuscripts, but then we're going to go beyond that and talk about issues of the, you know, how do we know the books in the New Testament are the correct books, you know, the canon of Scripture, and we'll talk a little bit more about the New Testament text in response to Bart Ehrman and some of his objections that are raised. We'll talk about the Gnostic Gospels and things of that sort. And then we'll try to spend some time talking about the Jesus myth hypothesis. And when I get to the Jesus myth hypothesis, there are some stuff in your notes about the Jesus myth hypothesis, but I'm going to give you a little handout to make it easier on that. So right now we want to talk about the historical reliability of the New Testament manuscripts. I'm going to step off camera so I can get out my glasses. Again, this is just a historical reliability. Let me recommend, though, if you want, a book that will go into more detail for the historical reliability of the Old Testament and of the New Testament. I think they focus more on the Old Testament, that go with Gleason Archer, that we talked about last week. Gleason Archer Jr.'s survey of Old Testament introduction. But for the New Testament, I would go to, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist by Norman Geisler and Frank Turek. And in there, they'll go through a lot of historical works where archaeologists and other historians have come up with, I think it's something like 80 confirmed historical facts from, the Book of Acts, things of that sort. So Frank Turek and Norman Geisler, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, would be a good place to go. And for your notes, it'd just be AP 23 in the beginning there. So just the 23rd page. Got it? Okay, and so the reliability of the New Testament manuscript. So again, we are not arguing, we didn't argue the Old Testament is God's Word, we're not arguing the New Testament is God's Word. That's going to come later on. Once we get Jesus on our side, or we get on Jesus' side, and we acknowledge that Jesus, we provide a case that Jesus is God, he can take the witness stand and tell us that the Old and New Testaments are the Word of God, without error. Okay? Until we get to that point, we'd be better off just arguing for the historical reliability. And first we're going to look at the manuscript evidence for New Testament reliability. And with that, you have three basic tests. They're called, I think Josh McDowell calls them, the bibliographical tests. And basically, what that involves are the number of copies. How many copies do you have? The gap between the oldest copies and when the original was supposedly written, and the reliability, the accuracy between all these copies. And I've got some little charts on page 25 for your Contendersly from the Faith books. On page 262, I just compare three writings, the New Testament, and then Homer's Iliad, which is in second place, and then Plato's writings just to show you the kind of evidence you can expect. And with the New Testament, you have over 24,000. Some are arguing that now we have over 26,000 copies. You know, and some of my students, these are handwritten copies. Some of my students say, well, that's, doesn't matter how many copies you have. If it's not reliable, it's not reliable. Well, wait, that would be like saying, okay, would it or would it not be news if we found a 600 AD fragment that was shown to be from the Gospel of John or from the book of Paul's letter to the Ephesians? That's going to be big news. And, but with, between 24,000 and 26,000 copies, second was Homer's Iliad with 643. Now some rounded off and say about 800, so I think they found a few more handwritten copies. But whatever the case, the gap between 24,000 and 643 is pretty big. With Plato's writings, you only have 7 copies. So, you know, when's the last time you heard somebody, you know, quote Plato and somebody complained, well, we don't know that Plato wrote that. We only have 7 copies. It doesn't happen. Because 7 copies is not that bad for ancient literature. And so, Plato, so the number of copies, so we'll just call it 24,000 for the New Testament. Homer's Iliad, we'll give him 800. It's probably much less than that. And Plato's writings about 7 copies. Plato, we're ending Plato just to show you this is kind of the norm. This is pretty much what you get for ancient literature. And now, the gap, what we're talking about with the gap is when the writings are complete, what's the oldest fragment? We don't have the originals pretty much of anything from first century AD. So, what's the oldest fragments? Oldest copy fragments that we have. And with the New Testament, you have the John Rylands fragment, a portion of John chapter 18 that dates back to probably within 25 years of the original. Now, here's why I say that. It was dated originally between about 115 and 135 AD. So what the New Testament scholars do, they take the latest date. So they keep saying 135 AD when it's actually dated somewhere closer. But now we have some papyrologists who aren't New Testament scholars, don't have their speculative theories, and there's some of them are starting to say that this fragment could go back as far as 90, the 90s AD. Okay, so, but the key is, most of the scholars that date it to about, you know, 120 AD believe John didn't write until about 90-95 AD. Okay, and I think John actually wrote in the mid-50s AD. By hijacking historical Jesus and redating the New Testament, I argue for that. But I'm also open to the possibility that John Rylands fragment may go back to the 90s AD. So you still have a small gap there, okay? But if you're looking for major portions of the New Testament, okay, if you're looking for major portions of the New Testament, look up page 263, most of John's Gospel, you've got the Bodmer Papyrus 2, which is dated between 150 and 200 AD. You have in the Chester Beatty Papyri, major portions of the New Testament, about 200 AD. By the way, I think there's a Korean scholar that dates the Chester Beatty papyri much, much earlier. So it might not be like 170 to 200 AD. But basically, you get by about 180 AD, you get pretty much large portions of the New Testament, okay? So there's nothing like this in all of ancient literature. All of ancient literature, you get much greater gaps, okay? By the way, let me say this. The evidence that the copies reflect, you know, Barger is going against the stream right now, but the evidence that the copies represent what the originals actually said are so strong that if you want to be a liberal New Testament scholar and attack Christianity, you'd be better off, you'd be more likely not to attack this gap, but to go when the originals were written. And you speculate that the originals were written, you know, between 67 and 100 AD, and then argue there's a, you go to the oral gap between when Jesus lived and died and rose, and when the first writings were written. So if you think Mark, well, to be totally honest with you, though, you got to deal with Paul. Seven of Paul's letters are accepted, and they usually date the first one, which is either 1 Thessalonians or Galatians, I think it's Galatians, the 49 to 50 AD. So now you only got a 20-year gap. So that's where these liberal critics now, the gap isn't between the copies and when the originals were written. There's so much, so strong, such strong evidence that we have accurate copies of the originals. So now they're going to the other gap. They're trying to say the gap between when it was first written and when Jesus actually walked the earth is too large. Well, with Paul, he only got 20 years. And then with, if you accept the 67 AD date for Mark, you've only got 37 years. But by the way, important events in my life, and certainly Jesus would have been important, I have tremendous memory of important events going back to when I was 8 or 9 years old. So we're talking almost 50 years. And so even if the dates, even if there was that big of a gap, that would not be problematic. Having said that, you can make a strong case if you just accept what the church fathers said about the writing of the Gospels, that there was very little gap. In fact, with Matt, I really believe the first edition of Matthew's Gospel was being written while Jesus was preaching, before he died and rose, because I believe Matthew was taking notes. Twice, Jesus calls the apostles scribes. And scribes are scribes because they scribble, not because they memorize. But whatever the case, you look at Homer's Iliad, and I think the gap there is 500 years. So the oldest copy we have of Homer's Iliad is 500 years. What happened between when Homer wrote the Iliad and the oldest copy that we have? Who knows, but historians are not really concerned. 500 years is not that big of a gap to have. It's only a big deal. When is 25 years a big deal when you're dealing with the New Testament? When is 500 years not a big deal when you're dealing with anything but the New Testament? So the issue is, you can accept Homer's Iliad as being historically reliable and authentic, reliable copies of the original, and it doesn't have to change anything in your life. If you accept the New Testament as being reliable, everything changes. And so that's why they need to attack that. Now the gap with Plato's, you got seven copies, and the gap is 1,200 years.
There are fragments of the Republican Nag Hammadi library.
Oh, really? No.
About 480, they have a fragment of the Republican.
And Plato's writing about 400.
But that's still, again, 900 years.
Yeah, yeah. So, but it has closed it up then.
Yeah.
And I didn't know. I thought that now, and are those fragments like quotations of it and something else? Because that would still count as a fragment. Was that?
It was a few paragraphs.
Okay. That's interesting.
That's one fragment.
We give the benefit of the doubt here, and now we can. What did you say, about 900 years?
480 AD, Plato walked the earth about what? 350?
About
450, something like that?
About 400 BC.
Yeah, so 800 years.
So about, we're looking at about 800 years.
But that's still.
Yeah.
And that doesn't include.
And it's only seven copies. By the way, they don't even compare the accuracy of the copies. I've never seen any given for the seven copies. More than likely, they're pretty much identical, but for all I know, they've copied. It's copied by the same guy, probably copied the same age, so it's not like, it's not even really, with that few copies, it's not a big deal. Unless there's discrepancies. In Homer's Iliad, you compare these 800 copies or so, and you have 95% agreement. With the New Testament, you compare the copies. You have 99.5% agreement. Now we get that 99.5% number from Bruce Metzger. And he's so far up the food chain, he was Bart Ehrman's mentor at Princeton. And so the Greek New Testament text that pastors and Bible scholars read, that basically Bruce Metzger was the driving force behind that. Bart Ehrman worked on that because he worked for his mentor, Bruce Metzger. And we'll see what that 99.5% agreement means when we respond to Bart Ehrman's attack on the New Testament manuscript. Now 95% looks like it's pretty close to 99.5, but it's really not when you're dealing with textual criticism, because this means that of every 1,000 words, how many are called into question? Be 5 out of 100, so out of 1,000 be 50. Out of 99.5, out of every 1,000, how many words would be called into question? 5. So, you know, one way of looking at that is that the copies of the New Testament are 10 times more accurate than second place of all other ancient literature. It just makes sense that, you know, and by the way, I think the reason why this was copied so accurately on Homer's Iliad was, you know, many of the ancient Greeks treated it like it was their Bible. I mean, it's Greek mythology. But whatever the case, when you have 24,000 copies, you can figure out who got it wrong. Okay? And we'll talk about that in more depth when we deal with Bart Ehrman as well.
I think Josh McDowell made a good point in the Washington Times. He said, what difference does it make what we have today is the same that we had back then if what we have today isn't true?
Yeah.
He made a really good point, and it kind of got me searching. We had Eric. What was it Eric? I can't think of his name. When we were at Clear Creek, and we were teaching. Eric
Henderson.
Henderson, yeah. So yeah. He brought some light to that too. So that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. And Eric Henderson was. He's the guy that I met that was worked on a master degree from a school out of India, and he lived here. And they were using my lectures.
Mm-hmm.
And then he found out I was local, so then he transferred to Columbia, got his master's degree. Then he went to Faith and got a master's degree in New Testament studies. Really sharp guy. He's probably going to end up doing a European or a South African PhD degree. You could do that dissertation only. You don't have to relocate. But whatever the case, if you see that the New Testament is more reliable than the any other ancient writing, you also have, by the way, too, a much wider distribution. Okay. But by the way, too, out of these 24,000 copies, over 5,000 are in Greek. Okay. So some guys are really picky. They're only going to use the Greek ones. They're not going to use translations. But we have old Latin translations and old Syriac translations that are older than most of the Greek copies. So, I mean, I think all of these hold weight. By the way, if we didn't have any of these, we would still have our New Testament today. Because I think just in the first 600 years of the history of the church, you can reproduce with the quotations of the writings of the church fathers. I believe it's the entire New Testament with the exception of 11 verses. Okay? And so it's really crazy to say, wow, this is so valuable. Look at all this evidence that we have. And then it turns out we don't even need it because it's been quoted so thoroughly.
So with that, you made, in one of your lectures when I was listening to you, you made a comment that the entire, like say, all the copies are gone. Church fathers, like you say, we can pretty much the entire New Testament. So with that, okay, we don't have, let's say we don't have any copies of the Old Testament. So out of that, with the church fathers quoting the New Testament, like word for word quotes, obviously in the New Testament we have a lot of quotes from the Old Testament. How much of the Old Testament would be able to be reproduced through the quotes of the New Testament? You know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How much of the Old Testament, and I started looking into it, but I never finished that.
Yeah, with the church fathers, they're going to quote the Old Testament a lot, but let's say a church father writes a letter as like 300 AD, and he writes a letter that's about as long as Paul's letter to the Romans. My guess is Paul's going to quote the Old Testament more than him, because Paul's going to the Old Testament for his authority, whereas the church father's probably going to Paul. Or the New Testament for his authority. At the same time, you can look at the early church fathers, and they were still, I mean, the original Bible of the early church was the Old Testament. And they're not Gnostics. They're not throwing out the Old Testament. They're not trashing it. So I would think you'd probably be able to reproduce large portions of it, but not to the degree that the New Testament, almost the entire New Testament, because mainly they're probably looking for... The number one reason for them to quote the Old Testament was for some Christological reason, something to do with Christ. And but whatever the case, you probably would find a decent amount. What's really interesting is I wish Dean Bergen had lived longer, because he was trying to study the church fathers to see when they quoted the New Testament. Were they quoting from the majority of the manuscripts, or were they quoting from the older manuscripts? Because that makes a difference between the Greek text of the New King James and the Greek text of the NIV, New American Standard, and all the other. And but he actually makes a case that they were quoting from the majority text. Yeah.
Who are you talking at, the church fathers, and how many years would that be?
Well, church fathers, they would start originally with the apostolic fathers. We're going to talk about them in just a few minutes. The pupils of the apostles, selected by the apostles to lead in the early church. And then the guys that they selected to lead, the guys that they ordained. And so basically for the first six or seven generations of the church, apostolic succession was the most powerful. powerful way to refute heresy. Because not all, not every city or town had copies of all 27 New Testament books. So if I could say, well, I was trained by him, and he was trained by an apostle, and the apostles never taught this Gnostic stuff. That's a pretty strong argument. And, you know, but eventually it gets to the point where, you know, Polycarp died in 156 AD at the age of 86, and he could say, well, I was trained by the Apostle John. The apostles never taught this garbage. Irenaeus could say, I was taught in 180 AD. I was taught by Polycarp, who was taught by the Apostle John, and the apostles never taught this. But after a while, that argument gets weaker and weaker and weaker. So we Protestants, and most Protestants do not put that much stock in apostolic succession. The Anglican Church will, the Eastern Orthodox Church will, and the Roman Catholic Church does. We see apostolic doctrine. So right at the point when apostolic succession is getting weaker, because the chain is getting longer, the links in the chain going back to the apostles, right around that time, you know, paper is becoming less expensive, more and more copies are being made of the scriptures, and so even if you're in a small town, your local church probably has a copy of all 26, somewhere in your town, there's all 20, copies of all 27 books, okay? But there was a time when, you know, if you weren't in Rome, Antioch, Syria, Alexandria, Egypt, Jerusalem, really before 70 AD, with Constantinople. I mean, if you weren't in one of these major centers, you know, you'd be lucky if you had four letters of Paul, half of the book of Revelation, and two of the Gospels. Okay? But as time went on, you know, they were more widely distributed. Now, some of the famous New Testament manuscripts. There's some you could, if you really want to look into, some of these manuscripts. Carsten P. Thiede, he based his work on O'Callaghan's work. Was actually, don't ask me how, but he was actually a Spanish scholar. But Carsten P. Thiede, you get a chance to look into some of his works. Because what O'Callaghan found was that the Dead Sea Scrolls in Cave 7, and then, by the way, they're papyrologists. It means that they study, they're actually scientists. They study ancient fragments. So they're like archaeologists, only rather than studying pots, they're just studying little pieces of paper. But in Cave 7 of the Qumran community, the Dead Sea Scrolls, is the only cave with Greek writings. Everything else is Hebrew, okay? And they have a few fragments there of Mark's Gospel, chapter 6. And there's reasons why the New Testament scholars reject it. The number one reason, they deny miracles, so they don't want early dates. So then number two, they date Mark's Gospel late enough to where we shouldn't find a copy of it in the Dead Sea Scrolls. See, the thing is, too, is they, and then they say, well, why would the Dead Sea Scrolls, that's a Jewish library, why would they have copies of the New Testament in there? Well, why not? I mean, there was a time when Christianity was just considered a branch of Judaism that acknowledged Jesus as the Messiah. That was perfectly fine. But once the Jews started realizing, wait a minute, they're worshiping Jesus, then all of a sudden the Jews didn't consider them. But the Qumran community, what's the difficulty with them saying we're going to have a library of Jewish literature and those who worship the Nazarene, we need to save some copies of their works as well.
Hey, forget also that the Qumran community is near Galilee. That's the Islamic community, which Christ was huge there. Mm-hmm. These people didn't forget Jesus that easily. They would have wanted the gospel because they had just thousands of people from Galilee near Nazareth had just been following him.
Yeah.
Of course, you're going to see some part of the gospel.
Of course, it's in the southern Judea area by the Dead Sea, but it's still. I think it's 42-10. Guys who are in Tarek, and I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, point out that within 150 years of Jesus' death, he's mentioned by 42 different authors. Now, some of those authors are the New Testament authors. Some are very early church fathers. Some are Gnostic heretics. But some are just Greek and Roman historians. And even a Jewish historian like Josephus. Emperor Tiberius, the emperor of Jesus' day, is only mentioned 10 times. Mentioned by 10 different authors. So why is a carpenter from Nazareth 4.2 more times likely to be mentioned by ancient authors than the Roman emperor of his day? So, I mean, if Jesus is having that kind of impact, even outside of Israel, I don't think it's surprising at all that we would find some fragments in one of the caves of the New Testament. So Carson T. Thede and O'Callaghan, their work. So you got a portion of Mark 6, you got a portion of 1 Timothy chapter 3, a few other writings that they identify. Now, there's all debates about it, and there's supposed discrepancies, but Carson P. Thede deals with them. I think there's a... Don't quote me on this, but I think there's a... a tau instead of a delta. Like a T instead of a D in one of the words in the copy. But when they found the warning, the inscription, the warning from the temple, that if a Gentile passes this point, he will be killed immediately by one of the temple guard, they also found like a T spelled with a D. And so what they started to, what Carson B. Thede is arguing, it's an issue of depending what part of the region you live in as to how you pronounce and spell that particular word. But whatever the case, these guys are, they're looking at something the size of a postage stamp with like 6.5 letters on one side and I don't know how many letters on the other side. But now through computer technology, we can confirm O'Callaghan's work that no other known writing in Greek literature that we know of to have that combination of letters except Mark's Gospel chapter 6. If you're debating somebody who has studied this issue and they're not a Christian, they're probably not going to give you these. Okay? Because most New Testament scholars have their own wild speculative theories. And they hold their own wisdom and their own theories in such high regard that they consider their wild theories, which are based on assumption after assumption after assumption. I cover the 16 different assumptions in New Testament scholarship, and hijacking the historical Jesus. And the bottom line assumption is that miracles are impossible. Therefore, the Jesus of the Bible cannot be the true Jesus of history. So that's why I'm so upset when evangelical scholars are now buying into so many of the New Testament liberal critics' assumptions. But whatever the case, another thing too, Carson Pedini said the Magdalene manuscript, it's a portion of Matthew's Gospel, and it was dated at, everybody knows it's from Matthew's Gospel, and it was dated, it's in London now, in the museum there, and it was dated about 200 AD, 170 to 200 AD, and he says, no, papyrologists, they can tell by the way letters are formed, the approximate time period, and so he dates it, I believe, to pre-70 AD, that copy. Now, an awful lot of New Testament critics don't want Matthew, the original, to be written until about 80 AD by someone other than Matthew, so an unknown guy. In fact, Ben Witherington III, probably one of my favorite evangelical New Testament scholars, he believes Matthew's Gospel was written 80 AD by an unknown author. So I mean, we're just throwing things away. Now, evangelical scholars that question whether Paul wrote some of his letters, and they just, well, just one of his real reliable disciples or something. It's just like, give me a break. The early church fathers, they all knew that Paul wrote all 13 of his letters. Yeah.
So you're talking about a lot of things that are assumed or supposed. Is there anything here that's absolute?
Yeah, what I'm putting on the board is absolute. We've got these copies. We've got this diagonal and stuff like that. What I'm also arguing that these should be absolute. In fact, Carson B. Deedy and an awful lot of papyrologists, they say, hey, look, we're the scientists. We're the ones who are dealing with empirical evidence. You're the wild speculative vessel. So basically what I'm slamming is the speculative theories of the New Testament critics who are attacking the Bible. Oh, these are the views of our opponents. Now, unfortunately, even with the views of our opponents, you can still build a strong case for the resurrection and deity of Christ. So, unfortunately, what a lot of evangelical Bible-believing Christian apologists have done is they've worked so much with the assumptions that our opponents give us that we're starting to look like our opponents now. We're starting to be skeptical in areas where Bible-believing Christians were never skeptical on.
I went and read the last two chapters because I had to do that.
Yeah.
And it was, all the things that were said there was astounding to me. And it did ring really true, like it, that could happen over societies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like death of Western civilization. And yeah, that was originally written in 1999 and wasn't warmly received in the evangelical scholarly community, but then I just re-presented the paper like a year ago and it got a much better reception. But now that Hillary lost, see what ends up happening is once a Republican gets into office, you'll have evangelicals realizing, wow, it's as bad as C.S. Lewis said it would get. This is the abolition of man. But then once a Republican gets elected, they say, oh, never mind, I guess it's not going to happen in our lifetime. It's just like, and normally when Republicans take control, and I hope this is not the case, but they usually do a real good impersonation of Democrats. So, but whatever the case, just keep in mind that there are some 60 to 70 A.D. fragments. There are some possible 60 to 70 A.D. fragments. That's one thing I really, you know, Dr. Geiser's getting up in age. He's born 1932. And I'm proud to call him one of my mentors, because in his Baker's Encyclopedia of Christian Apologetics, he actually defends the authenticity of these fragments. And I'm telling you, I don't know if there's any other big name apologist who would do that. Because they accepted so much of what skeptical New Testament critics have said. You know, I'm all for it in debate, taking what my opponent gives me and then arguing my case. You know, you give me enough rope to hang yourself in the debate, you know? So I'll take what my opponent gives me to argue for my case, but that doesn't mean I want to become my opponent. Okay? So sometimes we take what they give us, not just for purposes of debate, but we act like, yeah, if there's an event in the New Testament and it doesn't have multiple attestation, more than one source, then it's unlikely that it happened. I don't think we should hold, you know, it's like, we got evangelicals are talking that way right now, so. I'll try to bring more copies. I might have a few more in front of my Hijacking the Star from Jesus. There's a chapter on the hidden assumptions of New Testament scholarship. That will really help you to see, even when you're reading the works of William Lane Craig and Gary Habermas and Michael Kona and J.P. Moreland and even Dr. Geiser, when you're reading their works, they'll mention things like this passage is multiply attested, or this fulfills the criteria of the principle of dissimilarity, and you know, and they're basically just saying these are. Even when the New Testament critics, skeptical New Testament critics, try to stack the deck against Christianity, you can still make a strong case for Christianity. But I don't think we should stack the deck against Christianity and join them in that. But the universally accepted manuscript, John Ryland's fragment, John Ryland's papyri, a fragment of John chapter 18, that's dated between 125 and 130 A.D., although there are, you know, papyrologists saying that, no, it was originally supposed to be dated between 100 and 130 A.D., and we're now leaning towards the 100 date. By the way, this is found in Egypt, so it's, if it turns out to be go back to 100 A.D., what's it doing in Egypt that early? I mean, that just shows that, you know, you probably have, Christian communities at a very early time before you have a need for copies of the Gospels out there. Bodmer Papyrus 2 dates between 150 and 200 A.D. You have most of John's Gospel. And again, if the New Testament, I think the whole New Testament might have been complete by 70 to 80 A.D. Others would argue completed by 100 A.D. But if you've got most of John's Gospel already between 150 to 200 A.D. in copies, or the Chester Beatty Papyri, major portions of the New Testament by 200 A.D., I mean, that's the end of the ballgame there, man. That's just real, real reliable. Now there are scholars, and I do mention them in Hijacking Historical Jesus, that will date Chester Beatty Papyri much earlier, to like the 90s A.D. That, now, Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus. Vaticanus contains almost the entire Bible. Codex Sinaiticus, almost all the New Testament and half of the Old Testament. they date roughly to about 325 to 350 AD. Those are the two primary manuscripts from which we get all our newer translations, with the exception of the New King James Version. The New King James Version goes to the majority of the manuscripts, which I believe they're the majority because they knew they were copies of very reliable, trusted copies, which were copies of very reliable, trusted copies. I think, I don't know how we can be evangelical. Well, I don't know how we can consistently be evangelical and believe the Bible is the Word of God and believe in the inerrancy of the originals, of the autographs, of the inerrancy of the originals, no errors in the originals, if we don't also have a strong doctrine of the preservation of accurate copies. So, if God's going to go through all the trouble to give us an original Bible without errors, I think He's going to go, the Holy Spirit's going to work overtime to preserve these accurate copies, and I think that favors the majority of the manuscript. So I like the manuscript family of the New King James, but and we're going to see that in the end, it's almost identical to like the manuscript copies that went into the New American Standard of the NIV, with the exception of what the New American Standard brackets out. You still preach that, you know. So I believe Jesus really did forgive the woman caught in adultery. I believe those last 10 verses or so in Mark's gospel really do belong there. Okay, and I had him up to speak. Give 12 lectures on the resurrection, and a lady was quoting from a passage in the new that's the newer Bible's deleted, and a lady from my church after we went out to eat, and Dr. Habermas looked puzzled when I said, I preach from the New King James Version. He looked at me and said, no New Testament scholar is going to give you that. And because he builds his case to the resurrection on what New Testament scholars do. And, you know, I felt like saying, do I really have to consult New Testament scholars before I decide? Not believing New Testament scholars, I've got to consult them before I decide which version of the Bible to preach from. But instead I said, well, Dr. James Borland, a Liberty University school teacher, he helped translate the New King James. And he said, oh yeah, but the vast majority here, you know, I'm just like, I'm not going to select the Bible translation based on, you know, the consensus of guys, or some of those guys are the Marcus Borer type, so. But, so Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus, I think, who was it? Gordon Clark. He used to argue, he argued for the majority text too. He argued that Matthew's gospel disagreed something like 3,000 times or something in Vaticanus and Sinaiticus just in Matthew's gospel alone. So it's like, what, you know, by the way, there's corrections in some of those copies. Codex Alexandrinus, 400 AD, almost the entire Bible. Codex Ephraemi, about 400 AD, almost every New Testament book. So when you put all of this together, what it tells us is that the New Testament is the most reliable of all ancient writings. Okay? So when I was dialoguing with Robert Price, either the number one or the number two, Jesus Smith, are alive today, you know, I basically told him, when he said exactly what you would have before he would accept something as historical fact, I said, well, if you throw out Jesus because of that, based on your criteria, we'd have to throw out everything we know from the first century AD, we'd have to throw out any knowledge of the Roman emperors. And he said, I'm okay with that. And I said, yeah, that's the problem. Nobody else is. All the other historians think you're crazy, you know. And he felt he was kind of offended. He's a nice guy. I'd love to debate him in a time debate someday. But whatever the case, so that's the manuscript evidence. Let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll talk about evidence for the reliability of the New Testament manuscripts from the apostolic fathers and then ancient secular and non-Christian writers.